Meet Layla. She has had thyroid issues for a while. And in addition to fatigue, she was also dealing with digestive symptoms, brain fog, and she also started to get more yeast infections. She reduced sugar in her diet, and she started taking many different probiotics. But she found that that actually made her feel more bloated and more foggy. I met Layla when she joined my Thyroid Mystery Solved program. And after completing the in-depth assessments, we saw that in addition to her thyroid not being properly supported for her type, she also had many different Hashimoto's triggers, including candida. I knew exactly where we needed to start and what to work on to get to the bottom of her thyroid mystery.
Every year, thousands of people are told there's no explanation for their health concerns and no way to fix them. They feel frustrated, undermined, and lost. I know, because that was me before I figured out the actual causes and reclaimed my health. Now, I help others do the same. I'm Ina Toppler, and this is Health Mystery Solved. We just heard about all of the symptoms that Layla was dealing with, and joining me on the show today to talk so much more about this is Dr. Michael Biamonte. This is actually his fourth time on the show, and I just thought he was the perfect person to discuss this case. If you are not familiar with Dr. Biamonte, he was actually my original naturopathic doctor and clinical nutritionist 22 years ago now. Amazing how time flies. And he's the one that showed me that all of my ailments were actually so connected, and the reasons why I was experiencing all of the symptoms that I was back then when I was going through my journey. Dr. Biamonte is the founder of the Biamonte Center for Clinical Nutrition, and he's the author of the Candida Chronicles, a manual for Candida yeast infections. Dr. Biamonte, welcome back. I'm so excited to have you on Health Mystery Solved, Thyroid Hashimoto's Revealed.
Oh, absolutely. And once again, I am so proud of you, what all you've accomplished. It's really amazing.
Well, thank you. I appreciate that. And I have you to thank for everything that you've taught me over the years. And I'm excited to dig into this topic today. Now, just so that everyone is on the same page, and we have so many new listeners here, I want to make sure that everyone really understands, what exactly is Candida?
Candida is a fungus slash yeast. It's an organism which can transform itself from being a yeast to a fungus. And it lives primarily in your intestinal tract and in the mucous membranes of your body. It's normal to be there, actually. It's not something that your body would want to rid itself of totally, because it does have some function. It helps to stimulate the immune response in your body, and it actually serves as food for the probiotics that live in your body. Everyone by now knows what probiotics are. We see them all the time now on commercials. And the probiotics live in your intestinal tract, and they adjust the pH there so that your digestion's correct and you have proper motility of your intestinal tract. They help synthesize vitamins in your intestines. They help your body absorb nutrients from the food you eat. They help digest the food you eat. And they help produce an array of different nutritional substances as they digest fibers that you consume. So probiotics are your first line of your immune system in your body. Your immune system is actually split into six different divisions. And the intestinal tract with the probiotics is your first line of defense. That's your first immune system. What happens is, if something happens to throw these probiotics off or minimalize them, the candida starts to overgrow, because candida is kept under control by the probiotics. It's kind of like the food chain. You know, the little fish gets eaten by the bigger fish, and then the medium fish eats that fish. Well, the probiotics keep the candida under control in that same manner, like a food chain. So if something happens to the probiotics, they're not there to suppress the activity of the candida. And then the candida starts to overgrow, and it starts to become more dominant in your biome, your intestinal biome, than it should. At that point, it's capable of releasing many different toxic substances into your body. It can release mycotoxins, which are fungal toxins. It releases neurological toxins. It produces a ton of alcohol. There's actually a Japanese strain of candida that is so strong that it can legally intoxicate somebody and your blood alcohol levels will rise to the point where you could be arrested even though you didn't take a drink. That's how powerful this particular strain is. So Candida, when it grows into the point of becoming a pathogen, is actually capable of producing at least 75 different symptoms and many chronic illnesses that people are being treated for and being put on medications for. The problem is the average person never figures out or strings it together that it's Candida, because the symptoms it can produce can be so varied. Like, in some people, Candida can produce a lot of rashes and it can produce asthma. In other people, it can produce brain fog, and you can start forgetting people's names. You can walk in the room and forget why you walked into the room. What am I doing in this room? It can cause bloating, gas, constipation, diarrhea, an itchy rectum. It can cause chronic sinus problems. So if a person was to have even all of these symptoms of Candida that I just mentioned, they're so disrelated. Why would I think that my sinus problem has anything to do with the fact that I get rectal itching at night? You would just never string these symptoms together, which is why so many people have Candida and don't know it or don't pursue this.
Yeah. I mean, I guess that's why they call it the great mimicker, right? Because yes, it just mimics so many different things.
This is true. Now, in what I've found the hard way, I learned this the hard way, is that Candida has a particular affinity for the thyroid gland. And there have been many cases where the fungus itself actually grew into the person's thyroid.
Mm.
Those are also cases where they found that when they biopsied the person's thyroid, they had large amounts of mercury being stored in the thyroid. But Candida seems to want to mess your thyroid up. The one thing I can guarantee is that when you successfully treat a Candida patient and their Candida is gone, and 95% of the time, the next thing you need to treat with that person, because this is going to be the most outstanding problem, is their thyroid and adrenal function.
So why do you think Candida has such an affinity to the thyroid gland itself? Do you have any thoughts on that?
I don't know. I haven't ever spoke to anybody who gave me an answer to that.
Now, we also know, as you mentioned, that mercury and other heavy metals can have an affinity to thyroid too. Do you think there's a connection between, if is it possible that maybe that person is also higher in mercury or other heavy metals, and the Candida could be attracted then to the metals, which is why it's attracted to the thyroid, or the other way around possibly?
Either way, I agree with you. That's a plausible explanation, because we know there is some strange interreactions between mercury and thyroid, which again, no one has been able to really figure out 100%. But we know that Candida living in your intestinal tract will absorb large amounts of mercury and hold on to it. We know this because when we've treated people who were mercury toxic and we started to kill their Candida, huge amounts of mercury were released. And we found this mercury in their stool and their urine. We also know that mercury is able to suppress fecal IgA and IgE, which then allows Candida to grow more because you're suppressing the immune response. So that much we know, and that could be the connection. It's very possible.
And because so many people who already have hypothyroidism and know that they have hyperthyroidism and they have also Hashimoto's, there are some people, of course, who have hypo without Hashimoto's, but typically it's going to be both, or they may have Hashimoto's but haven't developed hypothyroidism yet. All of those people are at a higher incidence for having Candida. Just, we see that so often. So what do you think the connection is there? Why are so many people with thyroid issues and already diagnosed thyroid issues dealing with Candida as well?
Some of the answers to this are not what people would expect. One of the answers, obviously, though, is the thyroid plays a part in your immune system to help fight it off. But body temperature is one of the unsuspected underlying reasons. If your body temperature is lower than normal, you're more susceptible to fungal growth.
Wow, that is definitely not something that I think people would expect to hear. Why is that? Why is lower temperature? Is it just because the higher temperature is going to kill things off, and when it's lower, there's less of that killing ability?
Yes, it has to do with our white blood cells and certain enzymes in the body. The reason that our body temperature needs to be at a certain point, why that's considered normal, and why when it's not there, you get sick in various ways, is because when the body temperature is set where it's supposed to be, that temperature allows enzymes and white blood cells to function properly. So when the temperature goes off, these enzymes and white blood cells don't function properly, and then Candida is more likely to propagate.
What are some of the other reasons?
Well, I would have to go back to the general immune response. In the immune system, as I said earlier, has six different subdivisions. But basically, as far as your nervous system goes, the immune system is split between two branches, your parasympathetic and your sympathetic. So there's a sympathetic innervated immune response and a parasympathetic innervated immune response. And your anterior pituitary and your thyroid gland are responsible for the sympathetic response of your immune system against whatever it's going to be.
Now, going back to temperature, you mentioned that the temperature has to be ideal for the enzymes in the white blood cells to function. So what is that ideal? I mean, I know we always hear 98.6, but there's obviously a little bit of a range. What is that cutoff point where it wouldn't be optimal for your white blood cells and your enzymes to function well?
It's 97.8. That's what most agree to at this point. Eric Rind, who I'm sure you've heard of, Dr. Eric Rind on his website has probably the best data on body temperature and how it relates to your adrenal and your thyroid function. And his cutoff is 97.8. I don't remember what Broda Barnes said. Broda Barnes wrote the book that started everything in this regard. It was called Hypothyroidism, The Unsuspected Illness. And Barnes was the first one to really tie the temperatures into thyroid and, let's say, not being functional, having a non-functional thyroid, regardless of your blood levels of hormones being normal. And that was because he was aware that there was much more to thyroid function than just the level of hormone in your blood. He understood that there was something called the Krebs cycle and the electron transport chain that your thyroid hormone had to enter these chemical processes in order to do its shtick and produce the heat and energy that it's supposed to produce. But I would say most people are going to agree 97.8 below that is where you have you're chronically in trouble. 97.8 to 98.2 is probably a gray area, and above 98.2 is pretty safe as far as your thyroid function. We get people who are down at 96 and 95, which I'm sure you do.
I do too. Yeah. And I think this is a very simple test that anyone listening can do. It would just be first thing in the morning. You take your temperature, you know, before you really start to move around too much, you know, as you're getting out of bed to see where you are. And again, there's, of course, your adrenals. There's other things that play a role here, but it's a good way to check if something is happening. And then also know that if that's the case, then you have to be more on the lookout for candida, but also other infections as well, whether it's chronic viruses or bacteria, parasites, and things like that. Because again, you need your immune system and your white blood cells and enzymes to fight all of those things. So how would someone know if they have candida? As you mentioned, it has a lot of different symptoms. The symptoms can be related to many different things. Are there tests that you find are better than others? What are some of the ways that people can check to see if they have it?
Most people are going to go to their doctor and tell the doctor, I think I have candida. The doctor is going to say, well, everybody has candida. He's not going to differentiate between an overgrowth or not. He's going to say, well, do you have chronic yeast infections? If you don't, he's going to look and say, he's going to say, do you have AIDS? And he say, no, I don't. He's going to say, you probably don't have it. Don't worry about it. Go home. Now, if you press the doctor, you ask the doctor to do a blood test for candida antibodies. If your candida antibodies are high for candida, what that means is that at some point in time, your body had an overgrowth of candida that the body recognized as an overgrowth and was fighting it. The antibodies can remain elevated for as long as 9 months after the candida would be resolved. So it's not a guarantee that you still have candida in present time. The next thing you can do is you can get a test with a functional doctor that's called an organic acid test, and you could look for certain key organic acids, which would be high. The most famous is arabinose. If arabinose is high, there's a very good chance you have candida. You can also do some other things which are interesting. A nutritionist I used to work with called it the pasta test. He would have the person go out and eat a big meal of carbs, have pasta, have bread, have all these things, and then have some kind of sugary dessert, and then see how you feel within the next 24 hours. If this gave you an excessive amount of bloating, gas, brain fog, itching anywhere, your genitals, your nose, wherever, there's a very good chance you have candida. So even, but it doesn't have to be that elaborate. If a person knows that if they drink beer, for instance, which is high in maltose, which feeds candida, or if they eat a lot of sugar, they start getting bloating and they start having symptoms. That's a good chance that they have candida.
Now, is it possible that when they eat a lot of sugar, their blood sugar goes up and some of the symptoms could be related to the dysregulated blood sugar?
Some of them. Not itching wouldn't be. Mm-hmm. Bloating and gas wouldn't be, because that's fermentation that's taking place in your gut. So some symptoms, yes. But the key ones they want to look for is some kind of allergic reaction that involves itching or skin irritations, and then also fermentation, because remember, candida ferments. Candida is a yeast. So it takes the sugars and the carbs in your intestinal tract and ferments them and produces gas.
And what if they have something like SIBO, let's say, small intestine bacterial overgrowth? That can sometimes cause symptoms too. Do you feel like eating a higher carb meal could kind of show that it's a possibility of overgrowth of either, or you think it still more leads to candida? I'm just being devil's advocate a little bit.
And that's a great question, because it could be either. Mm-hmm. You don't have to, there's no law that says a person can only have candida or they can only have SIBO. We get patients a lot of times who have both.
Yeah, me too.
And that just makes the symptoms even more devastating that they have.
Yeah.
So we can conclude that if a person eats a lot of sugar or starch or something and they have digestive symptoms, they have some kind of dysbiosis. We can conclude that. Now, what the dysbiosis is exactly, is it candida or is it SIBO? That they have to figure out with a functional doctor.
Right. That makes sense. What about stool testing? People will say, well, I did a stool test and there's nothing here. A lot of times I know that could be a little deceiving when it comes to candida. Can you talk a little bit more about that?
And back in the early 90s, even before you were a patient, there was a lab that was called Great Smoky's Lab. That lab is now called Genova Lab. I was very friendly with the people there because we were kind of all starting out at the same time together. And they allowed me to have some of my patients do complimentary tests for free so that we could try to see the accuracy of what was happening with the stool tests back then. And this is when the CDSA test first came out. It was a big deal. And what we found was that people who had candida didn't always have candida showing in their stool. And we rationalized this because we knew that the way candida would grow in your intestinal tract was not in a very uniform manner. So candida in your intestines doesn't look like, you know, you're looking at a building and you see the moss growing right up the building like in an even manner. Candida more or less grows in a spotty kind of blotchy formation throughout your intestinal tract. So if you could walk through your intestines with a flashlight, you walk a bit and then you may come up to this area that has candida, biofilm, parasites, bacteria, all like in a clump. And then if you continue to walk, you'll come up to normal areas. And then you walk a couple of more feet and then again, you'll see one of these colonies. That's how it is. It isn't like lactobacillus or the other bacteria, which just are very uniform in their growth through your intestines. So it makes it harder for the stool sample that you have to obtain enough of that candida to make it grow in the lab by the time it gets there.
That is a great explanation.
So we discovered that all the people who had candida symptoms and were reactive to foods all had low lactobacillus, low bifidus, low E. coli, or none. So we determined back then that if a person had low on any of the three major friendly bacteria, whether it's gram-negative E. coli or the 2-gram-positive bifidus or lactobacillus, that would be an automatic diagnosis they had candida. Because after all, what's preventing the candida at that point? How can the person not have candida if they don't have any lactobacillus, acidophilus, or bifidus?
Right. They have no barrier, of course.
Right. And it rung true. The second discovery we made back in those days, which was fascinating, was trying to get bifidus to show up in the stool samples. And we would give people all these expensive preparations of bifidus and they kept coming back negative, 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 negative. And it wasn't until we got their candida down low enough and then started having them implant the bifidus directly into their rectums, either using an enema was one, or just taking a capsule of bifidus and shoving it up your butt and just leaving it there overnight. That's the only way we could get the bifidus to show, because it's very hard for a bifidus supplement to travel through your mouth, down your throat, your stomach, 40 feet of your small intestine, then get to your colon and actually start to re-inoculate. It's too hard, especially if there's candida there. So that was the next discovery we made as far as bifidus. Bifidus showing up in the stool, that saved people a lot of money back then, because people were taking all these probiotics and they were all going, you know, down into the toilet.
Right, right. Well, it makes sense when the candida is there, it can't get through.
It repels. There's polarity that exists between all these microbes. And it's just like when we were kids and we had magnets and we would play with the magnets and switch around the polarities and make them push away. It's the same concept.
Now, if someone does have, maybe they have a stool test and they have low bifidus, which is so, so common, when they do a enema using, you know, and they could just put a little bit of the bifidus in the water, right, to do the enema with it. Do you feel like that then actually colonizes? Because I'm just wondering, if they do a stool test, is it just the bifidus that you just sort of implanted that's coming out from that probiotic? Just because oftentimes they'll say don't take probiotics for 2 weeks before doing a stool test. Do you feel like it does actually implant if you give it some time?
Oh yeah, it definitely will. And they should not take the probiotic within 2 weeks of doing the stool test. That's a pretty hard, firm rule. This way you're not getting the results of any residue that's there. You're actually seeing what's colonized.
And that is definitely a very good way to save money, because you're using a lot less of it as an enema, and it's not even something you have to do every day, right? Maybe just a couple of days a week?
Yeah, 3 days a week is good.
And is that something that people have to do ongoing, or do you find doing that for a few weeks is enough to kind of get those colonies going?
Probably 3 months would be the maximum they would need to do.
And that's a great thing, because that's not something that a lot of people are talking about in terms of candida eradication.
Well, most people don't test. You still have to remember this. This is like, the people don't do what you and I do. They don't test people. They don't check these things, so it goes unobserved, and a lot of assumptions are made usually.
Now, for those that know they have candida, or you know they have a very big hunch that they do and they have all of the symptoms, one of the things, as you mentioned, they could do the enemas with bifidus, especially if they have a little bit of a bacteria. But what about ways to actually kill off candida? As you mentioned, candida can sort of live in these pockets. So what are some of the best ways for people to start, you know, as they work with their doctor to kill these things off? There's an herbal approach. There's, of course, a lot of different medications. Which do you like better? And is there one that you would do first before the other?
Well, the medications, number one, are a waste of time, because you can never take the medication long enough to kill the candida without destroying your kidneys and your liver. And aside from that, the candida is going to genetically switch and mutate and become drug resistant before you can take the medicine long enough to finally finish it off. Mm.
So tell us a little bit more about that, because that's not something a lot of people realize, because there's many people who are taking things like Lamisil, which is like a 6-month protocol, or even things like niastatin, which is, you know, a lot weaker, but people do that for sometimes a month or two at a time. So tell us a little bit about the genetic switches in candida and how it becomes resistant.
Well, I've seen people on niastatin for a year or two at a time, which that's a disaster. What happens is candida is composed of mother cells and daughter cells. And when candida mother cells are exposed to the same medication, whether it's herbal, whether it's pharmaceutical, doesn't make any difference. As long as it's something that kills in a pharmaceutical-like fashion, after 21 days of being exposed to that medication, the mother cells will genetically flip and they will switch to a different species. They will migrate, let's say, from being Candida albicans to Candida tropicalis. That's the most common migration that I have seen in terms of genetic switching. And tropicalis is a harder species to kill because it's more resistive to more medications. So after that 21 days, when the switching takes place, now the candida mother cells impart to the daughter cells that are going to now become mother cells what this data is. And genetically, they change so that the medicine is not going to affect them. This is why we hear from patients for so many years, well, I went to the doctor, he put me on niastatin, diflucan, whatever it was, ketoconazole. I felt great for a few weeks, and then all of a sudden, the symptoms started coming back. He raised the dose of the medication, and it made it even worse. This explains why you hear this all the time from people. I finally listened to the patients, and I went and hit the medical textbooks on mycology, and I learned these things about how candida would genetically mutate. And it was right there in the book, 21 days. is the sequence. That's when the sequencing starts.
So the idea then is to hit it with something else and then something else before the 21 days to prevent that.
Right. There's a series of things that can be done. If the person gets my book and reads my protocol, they're going to see the first thing that we do to attack the candida is go after it mechanically. We use enzymes to digest its outer layer. We use diatomaceous earth to physically dislodge it from the intestinal tract. We use other substances which loosen its ability to adhere to the intestinal lining. We use binders to snatch it right up and pull it out. And then we would go to botanicals, which work in a pharmaceutical fashion, but we rotate those botanicals, as you're saying. We usually switch them around every 7 days or every 4 days. Those are the botanicals that kill systemically. But then you have the deep-rooted candida that lives in the deep enclosures of your intestines, and that's the candida which in a way is the most dangerous because that's the candida repelling the probiotics. And to kill that candida, the most effective substances are the antifungal fatty acids, like caprylic acid, undecylenic acid, monolaurin. Those tend to be the most effective to reach and destroy that candida because those fatty acids are more going to absorb, let's say, into your intestinal tract. So right there, those are the three main sections of addressing the candida.
And that's really helpful because so often people say, oh, I'm just going to take this medication for one day and it'll be gone, right? I can't tell you how often. Like, oh, yeah, my doctor gave me Diflucan. I'm like, well, how many? One. I'm like, okay. I mean, it may be good for a vaginal yeast infection, possibly, you know, but that's about it. But even with herbs, so often people say, oh, I heard garlic is good. I heard oregano is good, which they are. But if someone has a big overgrowth, as you said, and it's been more chronic, just doing those for a few weeks is typically not going to be enough. It may help someone who maybe just has a little bit of overgrowth, but for so many people who've had it for so long, they definitely need more interventions.
Yeah, no, they need an exacting program that's going to have the correct potencies for the correct period of time, because otherwise they're scratching the surface.
Yeah.
The dangerous thing is when people get die-off and then they wrap it from the program, because they don't understand what's happening. That's another aspect of it. When you kill candida, you get a Herxheimer reaction. Dr. Herxheimer was the man who discovered this. He named it after himself. And we call it die-off when we talk amongst ourselves. Candida dies, it decomposes, it releases more toxins into your system, and your toxic control system in your body reacts to it. And basically, you feel sick. You feel tired. You feel allergic. And really fatigued, you might even feel feverish. You may have a lot of the symptoms of the flu. And people will say, oh no, this is bad. These medicines are bad for me. That's not the case. The candida is dying and you're just feeling sick because it's dying. But that's a good sign. It actually means things are working.
Now, if that happens, obviously people have to continue, but would you recommend that they back off a little bit so that these symptoms aren't as bothersome and so their body can catch up? Or is it something that they should push through?
They should never push through, because if you reduce your doses for 3 to 5 days, it allows your liver to get caught up with the detoxification, and your liver actually produces more enzymes which help you break down these substances. Drinking water is also like a major thing to flush it out of your system. Going for colonics are great too if you do that.
Yeah, what about binders?
Yes, binders are very important to help bind the toxins and then pull them out.
That's great. And it's really important for people to know that die-off can happen. And it can happen to anyone. It can happen to someone who has a lot of candida, and it can also happen to someone who may have a little bit less. It just depends on how sensitive the person is and how well their liver is working. So the die-off doesn't mean you did something wrong or you have more. It's just, you know, like you said, taking a step back a little bit, allowing liver to catch up, and then continuing, because it's a sign that there is more there and that we do want to support it. Now, what about for people who have hypothyroidism and Hashimoto's? There's a lot of things that can be potentially contraindicated in terms of certain immune boosting herbs and things like that. With the Candida protocol, is there anything that people with hypothyroidism and Hashimoto's need to be aware of? Anything that they want to make sure that they're doing more so of or just keeping an eye on?
Well, with the Candida program, the two most important things are your fluid intake and your bowel movements. Because if your bowels slow down, everything backs up and you become a toxic mess. If you don't drink enough water, that's also then reducing one of the routes of eliminating these toxins. So I would say with the Candida program, that would be pretty defined. When you're looking at a Hashimoto's protocol, you have to remember Hashimoto's is an autoimmune disease. So we don't want to do anything to throw the immune system in overdrive because it's actually going to make it worse. People have I don't know where this came about, but people have this strange misunderstanding that when you're allergic or you have an autoimmune disease, it means your immune system is weak. It's actually the complete opposite. People with allergies have their immune system in hyperdrive. Their immune system is reacting in a hyper manner to things it normally would not. When you have Hashimoto's, again, your immune system is all geared up looking to attack. So if you do anything that's going to stimulate interferon production in your body, and there's a few things that will do that, that person could just innocently bounce into. There are some herbs, Chinese herbs, that will do that because they boost your immune system. The trace mineral germanium, if anyone happened to take it, would also stimulate interferon. Even taking too much vitamin C could possibly stimulate interferon. So it's anything that's going to overstimulate your immune system could make the Hashimoto's worse. And that's something the person needs to be aware of.
Yeah. But in terms of the antifungal herbs, those are typically okay, correct?
Yeah, there's usually no problem there. Because they're dealing with the elimination of the microbes and not so much a systemic immune stimulation, like echinacea would do, as an example.
Exactly. And I can't tell you how often people with Hashimoto's take that and don't realize that it has this immune stimulating effect. And yeah, that's the beauty of some of these herbs. You know, they go after the specific bugs and many different bugs. A lot of them have many different functions. You know, they're antifungal, but also antibacterial and antiviral, which is nice too if someone has SIBO in addition to Candida or SIFO as well. A lot of these herbs can be helpful for some of those other bugs too. And it's not specific to immune, it's specific to just those bugs.
You know, I don't know how this came about though. Well, why people think if you have an allergy, it means your immune system's weak. Have you ever heard what the origins of this is?
Well, I think part of that is because people with autoimmune disease get grouped together with other things. So for example, even just COVID, right? How often did we hear, you know, when COVID first started, oh, if you're immunocompromised, you have to take more things, you have to be more careful, you have to do this and this, right? But often what they will say is if you're immunocompromised and or have an autoimmune disease.
Oh, I see what you're saying.
Then you have to be careful.
Yeah.
That's what, and again, I don't know if that's the origin, but I have so many, not just clients, but even friends who are like, oh, you know, this is like, again, when COVID first started years ago, they were just, oh, I'm being really careful because I have an autoimmune disease. I'm immunocompromised. And I'm like, but you're not actually immunocompromised. You have an autoimmune disease, you're not immunocompromised, but they would group themselves in that because that's how it was sort of, I guess, promoted.
Right. That makes a lot of sense. And that's another thing you just reminded me of as far as Candida that most people don't know is that Candida, there's a Japanese research study very recently that finally answered this question. Why does COVID cause Candida? Or why does the vaccine cause Candida? And a recent Japanese study found that COVID and the vaccine destroy bifidus bacteria in your colon. And this answers my question, because when COVID first came out, I had all of these patients coming back who had finished our treatment years ago and were fine. And they said, my Candida is coming back. And coincidentally came back after they were vaxxed or after they had COVID. So this study from the Japanese actually answers the question now why that is. COVID and the vax both kill your bifidus bacteria.
Interesting. And is that go for other viruses as well, like EBV, which often reactivates with COVID in terms of the bifidus depletion?
I don't have a reference on that, but I could tell you from experience that we've always kind of assumed that when a person had cytomegalia or Epstein-Barr virus, that it would retard their friendly flora. We kind of always assumed that, but I don't have any documentation on that. But it sounds like it would, because when people would get EBV, a lot of times they would start developing Candida at the same time. So it might be logical that the EBV was starting to retard their flora and the Candida was starting to grow. With a Lyme's patient, it becomes kind of obvious. They're treated with antibiotics.
Well, right. But I'm wondering also on the viral aspect of things, if there is a virus the immune system is going to be focused on that as like the big target. So the immune system almost takes its eyes off the other things and naturally can't support the gut. And then maybe that plus the low bifida, right?
Yeah, I could believe that. That seems logical. Sure. I could believe that.
So speaking of the good bugs and probiotics, obviously the natural approaches to candida are going to be more gentle to good bugs, but at the same time, you're still killing things off. So I'm sure it still has an effect on the good bugs. So we've talked about using enemas with probiotics. What do you recommend then in other ways to replenish? And do you do that in sort of the more traditional, like kill first, replenish later, or do you do it at the same time?
No, it's a waste, total waste of time to do it in the beginning or at the same time.
Agreed.
This is why all these companies hate me, is because I've been saying this for the past 20 years, all over the natural health media. It's a total waste of time to take probiotics until you have eliminated the candida. It just doesn't work.
Yeah, so I agree with you.
It doesn't work. And in order to get the probiotics back in the person with candida, it's not as easy as just taking two capsules of Acidophilus a day. That's not going to do it. The person who has had candida, his intestinal tract is so beat up, let's say, from having this, that you have to supply him with all the essential prebiotics that you can to encourage that environment. So he needs to have a correct fiber supplement for those probiotics to feed on. He needs to have things like FOS and inulin and other things that are going to help reestablish. Artichokes, by the way, are one of the best foods to help reestablish your flora. But a person must have he must have actually more prebiotics than probiotics in order to get that back. Remember, this is like gardening. This is, you plant your seeds and then you have to give it food and you have to water it. You don't put seeds there every day. You put the seeds and then you water every day. So you must feed those probiotics in order for them to be able to really reinoculate. We actually put Saccharomyces boulardii in the category now of a prebiotic.
Yeah, and Saccharomyces boulardii, for those who may not be familiar, it's a type of beneficial yeast. It doesn't colonize, but it can actually help to take out and kind of retard the bad yeast and help to promote probiotics as well. Now, what do you say to people who find that when they take prebiotics, so the inulin or chicory, the FOS, they start to feel bloated from that? And there are some people who say, you know, it's something that's going to feed everything. It doesn't know what's good, what's bad. How would you address that?
Well, normally those people have SIBO or they have some kind of other dysbiosis that hasn't been treated. Well, that's not totally true. There is a phenomenon that occurs. Specifically, I know this to be true on my protocol. When we have the person ready for the probiotic program, which has probably 10 different prebiotics, and then it has the Acidophilus for the small intestine and the Bifidus for the colon, they will go through a phase of about 2 or 3 weeks of increased gas and bloating, and then it diminishes. And the increased gas and bloating appears to be the propagation of the probiotics, and the probiotics then eliminating whatever candida is left. That's as best as I can tell, because we've done stool samples on these people at these precise times, when before they took the stuff, when the bloating and the gas were at its peak, and then when it started to die down. And we saw the shifts in the flora, which was very interesting. We're actually writing a paper on that, because no one's ever done that before. And it's just fascinating to watch the symptoms and watch how the flora changed. So on my protocol, it's going to be expected. I tell the patients, you're going to get an increase in gas and bloating for about three weeks or so. But by the time you speak to me again, it should be mostly gone. And then that's typically what we hear. When we hear that the gas and bloating is continuing or getting worse, then we know there's either unhandled candida or there's some other kind of dysbiosis that we weren't aware of.
So really, it's very important that in an ideal situation, people get rid of not just the candida, but all dysbiosis before they start any type of prebiotic, because you don't necessarily want to put this fertilizer in to fertilize potentially bad bugs.
Klebsiella is one of the organisms that's particularly sensitive to FOS, unfortunately. If you have Klebsiella and you take FOS, it's going to really make it spread.
Not something that is tested in a stool test, whether that's Genova or Diagnostic Solutions. So that's something that people can always check and see. What are your thoughts about doing probiotics without prebiotics for those that may not be able to handle them? Do you feel like that still can be effective, or maybe doing that along with, say, like postbiotics, like butyrate, propionate?
It could be effective, but the butyrate is part, again, that's another prebiotic that we use. So it's still in that category, but it's not as effective. And I would want to handle why they can't handle the prebiotics. If they can't handle the prebiotics, there's a reason. So I would say handle the reason rather than trying to get along without them, because it's the difference between a Volkswagen and a Rolls Royce.
Yeah, no, it's really interesting to hear this and for everyone listening to really understand this part, because depending on, you know, who you speak to, there are a lot of practitioners who don't recommend prebiotics because of the bloating, but it's also not having that understanding that you said, that that just means something else is there.
The reason the other practitioners don't recommend prebiotics is because they've never successfully gotten rid of the person's candida. That's the real underlying reason. They haven't really handled the dysbiosis that's there. So they're just getting a kickback of the person's reaction to taking these products at the wrong time, when the body's not, the environment's there is not suited for them.
Now, for those that are dealing with candida, there's so many different symptoms. And on top of that, they're also having their thyroid symptoms and their Hashimoto symptoms. So it really is a lot. And, you know, it's a process. So just to give everyone some hope and understanding, how long does it typically take? We know it's not an overnight process, but if someone has a moderate amount of candida and they're having a lot of symptoms, in their mind, you know, what time frame should they be mindful of, and, you know, the total time, but also within that time, when can they start to see improvements? When can they feel that there's some shift that's happening?
It's usually within the first 4 months. Most cases now, we can get rid of the candida and re-inoculate the flora in 8 months if the person doesn't have any interruptions. If they don't have to go on vacation, if they don't have to go to a wedding, if they don't have to get into an accident, or if they don't have to do these things, if they're pretty much nose to the grindstone, we can turn it around in 8 months. And usually during that time that the candida is dropping, if you watch their thyroid antibodies, you'll see the antibodies will start dropping.
Candida is such a trigger. I mean, there's so many triggers for Hashimoto's, but it's one big one for sure. And I've seen it firsthand myself and with so many people. So yeah. Now, what about in terms of food? There is the candida diet, which is going to be a very low sugar, low starch type of diet that is very important and helpful so that you're not feeding the candida as you're trying to kill it off. But 8 months is a long time in terms of the process of killing it off. Does someone have to be on a strict candida diet for the entire time, or is there a time where they can start to open things up a little bit?
Usually when we put them on the probiotic program, which typically occurs in month six, at that point, we start to change and manipulate their diet to include prebiotic foods, let's say, foods that actually will encourage the growth of the probiotics. There are particular fruits and vegetables that you can eat in that stage. Now, it depends on your blood type, though. We've found that this is a little tricky. Blood type A's are the easiest to work with in that manner, because blood type A's are more receptive to carbohydrates and foods of that nature in the first place. With a blood type O, it's not as easy, but you just have to know which foods go. So, and the way we did this, which was the simplest way, is we just looked at the book, Eat Right for Your Blood Type by Diadamo, and we looked at the foods that are more beneficial for an O and an A or a B or whatever, and we just looked at which of those foods were the foods that encouraged your friendly bacteria. Which are the foods that you could call a prebiotic food? And that's how we modified their diet.
And usually with diet, especially if it's something that's new, it always is a little bit harder in the beginning because it's something new and people have to adjust. But what's nice with killing off candida creates a lot of cravings. It literally wants you to eat more carbs and sugars. So as that gets killed off, those cravings tend to go down, and then it's easier to stick to the diet, and then your body gets used to it as well. So it might feel a little bit like a struggle because it's new in the beginning, but then it does get easier over the coming months.
And that's interesting that you said that. That you said that the candida wants you to eat more of these foods. Because there are a few studies that have come out in the last 6 months that are pointing to the fact that there is some type of telepathy that occurs between microorganisms. Particularly, they were looking at a telepathy that occurs between gut flora and different pathogens. Some people have stuck their necks out to the point of saying that the flora actually has telepathy with the host and might try to influence what the host wants to eat. Because I've heard, and I've heard this anecdotally, I've heard this for years. Patients will tell me, I want to eat the sugar. Something's telling me to eat the sugar. I don't know what it is. I don't want to eat it. And something's just making me do it.
Mm.
And then as their candida goes away, you start hearing that dissipates.
Right.
So maybe in the next few years, we'll find out more about that. But it's just an interesting point you made in light of these new references about telepathy that actually exists between microorganisms.
Yeah, it's so interesting. I actually wasn't aware of that. I was saying it more from a cravings perspective and just that gut-brain connection and the cravings that happen because candida wants to eat. So you're naturally getting the cravings, but it's so interesting to take it to the next level. That would be very, very exciting to see the research that comes out on that.
Candida is like a huge Italian family on Christmas, the way Candida wants to eat. Absolutely.
Right. Yeah. Oh, Dr. Bayamonte, this has been so helpful. Thank you so much for telling us more about Candida, but also not just the basics, but really getting in depth about why it's so complicated, why it's such a mimicker, and then most importantly, ways that we can resolve it. Because whenever something happens and it feels like, you know, there's so many symptoms, you have so many things going on, it can be really frustrating and confusing and can also feel really lonely to not know what to do. So it's just really great to know that there are solutions out there. And as I always say, the answers are out there and there absolutely is hope. So thank you for giving us that hope. And for those who want to connect with you, who want to find out more, where can they contact you and how can they find you?
They can go to my websites, health-truth.com, the New York City Candida Doctor, the New York City Thyroid Doctor, any of those three websites, they can find me. Here's something we found recently that is a real good idea. If someone is going to buy my book, The Candida Chronicles, which is on Amazon, don't buy one copy, buy two, give one to your doctor.
If only the doctor will read it, huh?
The doctor who is unsuccessfully treating you, get him had it so that he knows what he's doing wrong and he can start getting up to speed on things.
Yeah, that's a great idea. Well, thank you so much for being here. I so appreciate it. I feel like you and I can talk for hours. There's probably three more episodes in the works right now, and I'd love to have you back to talk much more about this later this year as well.
My pleasure, Ina.
As you just heard, Candida has so many different symptoms and can be such a trigger for Hashimoto's. For Layla, we first started by supporting her thyroid type. This is crucial before attempting to clear any of your triggers, really, because when the thyroid is not optimal, it makes it so much harder to do anything else, including any type of detox, believe it or not. And by the way, if you don't know your thyroid type, it's something that you want to determine because understanding your thyroid type is one of the main things that you need to get rid of your thyroid symptoms. So if you don't know your type, please be sure to join me for my next free training, and I will explain how to identify your type and then how to use it to support you. It's virtual, done on Zoom, so you can join from anywhere in the world. I would really love to connect with you, get to know you better, and support you. You can register for the next free training at inatoppler.com/Zoom call. That's inatoppler.com/Zoom call. It's totally free, and I'm going to put the link to this in the show notes. And for Layla, once she was on the right support and her thyroid hormones were optimized, we then started to go after the candida. While this is a bit of a process, it's something that I love to simplify for all of my clients and students in easy step-by-step protocols. We started with addressing the biofilms with one of my favorite products called Interphase. And then we went through three phases of candida removal that I customized for her in the program. She felt a bit more bloated for the first week, which is quite normal. However, as she finished phase one and went into phase two about 3 weeks later, much of that subsided and her digestion sped up and her bloating went down to the point that her pants were able to fit again and she didn't have to unbutton them by the end of the day, which was so exciting. We then finished out the plan with rebalancing her microbiome, and we used ingredients not only to help put probiotics in, but also things to help to diversify the microbiome, which is just so crucial. It took about 12 weeks, but what a difference. Layla was so excited, And of course, so was I. If Layla sounds like someone you know, can you please share this episode with them? And be sure that you're subscribed to the show so that you never miss another thyroid mystery. As always, please remember, when it comes to your thyroid issues, the answers are out there and there is hope. I'm Ina Toppler. Thank you so much for listening. And I will see you on the next episode of Thyroid Mystery Solved, Hashimoto's and Hypothyroidism Revealed. Bye for now.
All information, content, and material on this podcast is for informational purposes only and is not intended to serve as a substitute for the consultation, diagnosis, and/or medical treatment of a qualified physician or healthcare provider.